You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
I'm going to go ahead and run through some introductions and some disclaimers. So, as always, everybody, welcome to our panel today about investing, how to do it well by investing in quality businesses that have staying power. This panel is sponsored by TIMA ETFs, who manage the TOLL Fund, ticker T-O-L-L, that invests in quality companies with durable moats. We'll cover a variety of topics today, ranging from what is a quality stock, how compounding works, what a moat is and is not, and how valuation works in this type of investing. Those of you who have attended our spaces before know that I really like to keep these panels wide open for discussion. So as we kind of go along through the questions, through the discussion, please feel free to chime in if you've got something to add. I only ask that we keep all microphones muted while others are speaking, just to avoid any kind of overlap or audio feedback. So please allow just a breath of air before chiming in after another speaker finishes. As we will be discussing individual investments, it's extremely important to note that each of your individual circumstances are different. So you need to make sure that you read about each investment carefully to make sure that it fits your risk and return profile. Also note that nothing in this panel should be construed as an actionable financial advice or a solicitation to buy or sell any security or derivatives. Always conduct your own research or discuss with your licensed financial advisor before making or taking any given investment. So to start us off here, let's get into some introductions. With us, we have Yuri Kojamirian, the CIO of today's sponsor, TIMA ETFs. Yuri has over a decade of experience managing UK and global portfolios and co-managed the Magity Fund, raising several billion dollars in assets. Thanks for coming again, Yuri, and for sponsoring today's panel. What else should we know about you?
Thanks for having me. I think you pretty much covered it. I've been an investor for a very long time. I caught the bug early on. I've always been fascinated with how markets work and different companies and, you know, what makes a share price go up. And straight out of university, joined Magity as an analyst on a long short fund, working very much in this investment style, and then got promoted to run a fund and been very fortunate that this has been my career and my passion have sort of aligned. So really looking forward to the panel today.
As am I. Thanks again, Yuri. We're also joined by Jerome from Quality Stocks, a service providing daily momentum plays and small cap stock picks and education. Thanks for coming today, Jerome. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here today. So I'm Quality Stocks, Jerome. My background is strategy consulting. So I work with companies to help them define their strategies. And I think that's why I have a strong focus on understanding business models, market dynamics, and focus on competitive advantages. And I of course, love investments, stocks, and so on. It's my passion. And what I love about that is when you invest in a stock, you're part on an adventure with the teams and with the management of a company. And I think that's really exciting.
Hey, really excited to have you and your experience here today. I think we're going to have some pretty good discussions. We'll have one more panelist on the way, and that will be Martin Peltier Always love having this guy on, getting his perspective on investment. Martin is the Senior Portfolio Manager for Trivest Wealth at Wellington Altus Private Counsel, a frequent columnist for Financial Post, and as I understand it, a pretty top-notch skier. So with those introductions posed, I want to start us off here. We're going to have a lot of different ranges of investment experience in the audience, and there's one unifying focus of our panel today, and that is the topic of quality investing. For a lot of people, this might be a relatively new term. So Yuri, why don't you start us off here? What do you think quality investing is all about? If we're looking at this from, say, I'm a brand new investor just now starting out, why should I focus on this area of the market when compared to like value growth or other terms I may have heard?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think the way the investment world is that there's obviously lots of different strategies and different ways of investing. It sort of makes the market, if you will. And if you're starting out, it can be a little bit dizzying to kind of understand what all these terms mean. What are these different strategies? Value is one that people have heard a lot about. I think quality investing, which we're going to talk about today, is a really attractive strategy because it's the sort of ultimate sleep at night investment strategy. The idea is you buy companies that have shown a consistent high return on invested capital, which is a technical term, but really quality businesses with good business models, good outlooks, high recurring revenues. And this quality factor, a lot of the literature has identified, has really led to consistent outperformance of markets and across all kinds of markets, different industries, different geographies, different periods. And it's always been there. And it's basically a nice strategy for people to sort of lock away, because what happens when you invest in a quality business is almost it does all the work for you, if you will. What it's doing is that these high returns on invested capital, the company is generating, it's able to kind of compound value over the long term. And we'll talk about compounding, I'm sure, here as well. But the idea is that you just buy these businesses, lock them away and not worry about too much. What happens, because over time, these businesses should build up value. And for our TOL strategy, the ETF, what we've done is we've kind of looked at the quality factor and we wanted to give clients a strategy that could be a core part of their portfolio that could fit within this sort of quality allocation so they could take advantage of this quality factor that exists out there. And we came at it from this perspective of moat investing, which again, I'm sure we'll talk about. But the idea is to protect that quality over the long run from competitor threats and to look for companies where there's this durability to this compounding quality. And that creates really good businesses that are worth holding in your portfolio. That would be my description of it.
Thank you, Yuri. Jerome, I'm really curious. What's your take on quality investment? Just so we can kind of get a feel for the panel at large here.
Yeah, so I think quality investing is investing in strong fundamentals, of course, and companies that are able to perform well across market cycles. And I think that offer a degree of safety. And of course, when you invest in a quality company, you invest on a strong competitive advantage, a strong business model, often companies that are well managed. And so I think as an investor, it gives confidence. And if you are confident in your investment, you can keep your stock for much longer than if you're not. And the total return you will have in investor often depends on how long you keep your stock. So I think quality investing is also important for the confidence part.
Thank you, Jerome. Really good explanations there from both of you. I think we're getting a good picture. Martin, so glad to have you back. I already cut in with your introduction, but I'm happy to have you here, man. We're just kind of going over our own personal definitions of quality investing. So I'd love your perspective on that, just as the main topic there, Martin.
Perfect. Apologize for being a little late here something I'm quite excited about. Looking at quality, it basically comes down to the safety margin that you're going to get in regards to ensuring the implied valuation, intrinsic value of what you're investing in is secure. And so you want to look at the quality of the company's ability to deliver on their free cash flow over your investment period. Now, people will pay a multiple in public markets for that expectation. And so that multiple could be quite large, it could be quite small, it creates that said opportunity. And some people allude to putting quality in addition to value together. And that isn't always the case. You could have some high growth companies that are high quality as well. And so what you want to look for is companies that are able to deliver on that free growth, that free cash flow growth, in addition to what that value is going to be on judgment day. And I think that's important. And so if you're paying too high of a multiple now at, let's say, 40 times free cash flow, and they could still deliver some strong cash flow growth, but if they are unable to maintain that multiple at the value at the judgment day, or whenever your end of your investment period is, then you could get caught offside. So it's important to look at quality independently at first, and then look at the value, and then put the two together.
Thank you, Martin. So I want to dig a little deeper into that. Now we have three kind of very similar definitions of quality investing. What I'm curious about now for you, Yuri, is with all of that in mind, how does the Toll ETF kind of utilize this concept in your investment strategy?
Yeah, it's a really, we thought long and hard about the sort of universe of quality companies. And what we tried to think about is, what's the most important characteristic? And we sort of settled upon durability. The beauty of compounding is, as you know, it's sort of an exponential growth curve, right? And I think a lot of people, human beings in general, don't really can't fully grasp what exponential growth is. One of the great analogies that I've seen is kind of a lily pond, right? And if you imagine the lilies doubling every day, right, which is what exponential growth is at its extreme. If you imagine the lily pond is full, the question is, at what point do you think that lily pond was half full? And the answer, which surprises some people, is, well, obviously the day before, right? And what it tells you is that you have to be around for that day, right? Meaning you have to be there for the sort of, if on the 30th day it's full, you have to be there on the 29th to get that huge increase in value. And so durability is what matters. And how do you get durability in the stock market? Well, you have to look for companies that have competitive advantages. So they have this term that was popularized by Warren Buffett, they have moats. So they have some sort of defense around their business that means that other competitors can't get in, which protects their return on invested capital and gives you that nice compounding effect, that durability over time. So we thought, okay, we want to focus on durable moats, but how do you actually go find those durable moats? What are the other characteristics of these types of moat businesses? And the other two that we found worked really well as a subset of quality companies is tangible moats. So here I'm maybe going to do something controversial. We can discuss later with the other panelists is we're focused quite a lot on moats that you can kind of feel and touch. I mean, to use a metaphor, really effectively things that are real and really protect the business over the long run. And then the third bit that we found is dominance, which I think is a really nice characteristic, hence why the fund is kind of focused on monopolistic businesses as well and has the name Monopolies in its name. What if you kind of combine these things together, durability, and here I'm talking about long term, decades of durability, actually being able to feel the moats and a dominant position that the companies acquire because it's created value for customers, that creates what we think is one of the best neighborhoods of companies to invest in the stock market. And then we do fundamental equity analysis on those to pick the ones that we think fit in general other quality type criteria that we can talk about, good management teams, business models, all the kinds of things. And if you do that, you in theory put yourself in the best possible chance of outperforming over the long run, notwithstanding the valuation question, which is also important that we can get into as well.
And we definitely will. You said a lot of stuff that I've got queued up, so I'm pretty excited to dive in here. Jerome, you've also been a pretty big proponent of quality stocks across numerous geographies. And I know you gave us a little bit of rundown at the top, but could you kind of give us a little background on what attracted you initially to quality investing and how you've kind of developed that over time?
I think the simple way to present it is to say that I think that quality investing is the easiest way to invest, because what you are looking for is strong business models, good management, and so you have a lot of time to analyze, to identify whether a company can be great, can be interesting, and you don't focus on short-term element. And so you're not using the stock market as a casino, but really as its initial purpose, so a long-term investment. And so I think that I began to invest in quality companies because it's easier.
Ain't nothing wrong with keeping things simple, I would say. So we do keep, you know, we're hammering home this entire concept, quality stocks. I want to pick your brains a little bit about what actually makes a quality stock. So there are a ton of metrics you can read about that define quality. There's even a ton of disagreements about what can define quality. And I actually have a few things queued up to discuss to that end. But many of the key features are qualitative and hard to measure. So I'm wondering, I'm going to pin this one to Martin and Jerome, starting with Martin here. Could you tell us what you think makes a company or a stock a quality one? And maybe focus on, you know, your top three or four metrics in selecting a quality company.
Okay, so I was a sell-side analyst for 10 years. So I really got to spend a lot of time with companies globally, and small, mid, and large. And the common denominator among those that were the highest quality was those that had a competitive advantage, but that competitive advantage had a top quality captain at the helm. And management is, I know it's overplayed, but really is imperative. You have to have a really good management team. Simon Sinek put this great chart, and he evaluated looking at SEAL Team 6, which is the top SEAL team of SEAL teams. And on the horizontal axis, it was trust, and on the vertical axis, it was performance. And we tend to go with people in the leadership role that have a strong performance, may not have the highest trust factor, and that creates toxicity, and it doesn't create sustainability. And it can create wreak havoc on a company. Whereas in SEAL Team 6, they would take those with a little bit less performance, but a very, very high level of trust. And so everyone's working together to achieve that common objective. And that, it really is an intangible, but it's important to try your best to get an understanding of that team and measure its you know, importance as to what its driving factors are. And you can see that in its financial numbers, all kinds of different ways you can look, you can skin that cat. But you can typically, what I look for is teams that, and this is a very easy way to do it, is teams the first go around did well, you know, they made mistakes, but then the second go around, that's the sweet spot, because they've learned a lot from the first go around. They didn't make as much money in the first go around, but the second iteration, they're geared to make a ton of money, and for their clients, or for their investors, for everybody in the ecosystem. And then the third go around is, you know, they're looking for that corner office per se, and it's you know, a little bit more complacency, and it's not together. And so if you can really get into, if you're looking at the fundamentals of it, visiting the company, getting to really understand the depth of that organization. And I think that's imperative. That's the number one thing that we do.
Great explanation there. Jerome, I'd like your take here as well. Do you agree with the trust versus performance factors where trust and cooperation among that management kind of holds a pretty high tier of importance?
Yeah, of course, it's actually hard to disagree with that. I agree that the quality of the business model is the most important thing you have to look at when you want to invest in a quality company. And to assess the quality of a business model, you can, of course, look at the competitive advantage. What does the company do to be ahead of its competitors? What is the demand for its products or services? How well it's positioned in the market? And the quality of the business model eventually always is in the metrics. And the main metric, I will not talk about the one that everybody is talking like ROIC, net profit margin, growth, and so on, because we see that a lot. I think the main metric that show a quality business is the market share. If a company is gaining market share, usually it's a good sign that it has a competitive advantage and it has a growing moat. And I think that's a very, very strong metric. And of course, you don't see that in the financial results. You have to study the market. You have to study how well a company is positioned in its market. But I think it's really important to do that when you want to invest in a company.
Thank you, Jerome. We'll definitely get to moats here in just a minute, because I know that there's a lot there, and there's probably plenty of people in the audience who aren't quite familiar with what we mean by that. So we'll get to that after this next one. Yuri, in your process for the Toll ETF, back to that topic of finding quality stocks, you focus on a new term that I'm not particularly familiar with called operating base. Can you break down what that term means and how it's utilized at Tema?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess the way I've described our investment process is, if we've identified these durable, dominant, tangible moat companies, we create what we call like a proprietary universe of these types of businesses. And just echoing what Jerome was saying, you know, this isn't something you can just kind of look up on a Bloomberg terminal. You really have to do the bottom-up work to find these types of companies, understand their business models and their competitive positions and moats. But once you've done that, you typically get a list of that can be, you know, as long as 500, 600, 700 companies. And the question is, well, you can't invest in all of them. So how do you build a portfolio of companies? And here we employ a fundamental equity selection process that has been developed over many, many years by myself and some of my colleagues. And we've looked at sort of trying to understand what it is that makes a good stock. And we settled on this idea of an operating base, which is a kind of all-encompassing term. But in theory, what it is, it's just a question. Does the business have a good operating base? And what we mean by that is, can you get into the weeds of the business, you know, and really understand, does this business have a good business model, a good management team, as was said before, which is really important. And overall, is it kind of going in the right direction as a company itself? It might have the best competitive advantage in the world, but if the business is doing value destructive acquisitions or focusing its efforts on low value areas or whatever it might be, then it doesn't really fit the criteria of having a good operating base. So it's a selection criteria for us, but it's a selection criteria. We've set the hurdle high, right? We have to do the work to understand whether these companies fit this. And that's why we've gone for a term that maybe isn't taught in a lot of business schools, but it's more of a, echoing kind of what Jerome was saying, a consulting term, right? Like, on the factory floor, is this genuinely a good business that you would want to invest in? And then our businesses have to meet this criteria, along with three other major criteria: valuation, balance sheet, and cash flow, and whether we have an edge in that stock, which we can also discuss, but this is really one of the key focuses here. And I'd just like to pick up on one point, which is the market share point. I really want to echo that. I think that's very, very important. we focus on monopolistic businesses, and often we get set, you know, monopolies are bad for consumers. But the truth is, companies that have gained a lot of market share, they've created a lot of value for their customers. And that's why customers have flocked to them and have given them that market share. And we look for these types of businesses that are kind of inconspicuous, if you will. They create value, but hence the ticker TOLL, they take a small toll. And over time, people gravitate to them because they give a lot of value away to customers. I think that's a way to build a long-term, very sustainable business.
Thank you, Yuri. So kind of let's dive a little bit more into this concept of moats. And I'm going to start with you here again, Yuri, especially since, you know, your TOLL ETF is up about 36% since inception. It leans very heavily on moats, in that quality companies with durable dominant moats. And of course, the quote comes directly from Warren Buffett himself, a pretty famous line: a good business is like a strong castle with a deep moat around it. I want sharks in the moat. I want it untouchable. So Yuri, can you explain real quick what moats are and why they're so important?
Yeah, we've variously used this term now through this conversation. And I do think it's important to take a step back and really appreciate what it is. The concept's really intuitive, right? You're thinking about something even a child can understand, right? A protection against competition. But what it looks like in business analysis terms, typically you get it divided into, we like to look at five different sources of moat. The first is called economies of scale. So these are businesses that get a certain amount of size so that the unit cost of production is much lower than their competitors, giving them an advantage. If you think about semiconductor manufacturing, right, we're getting lower and lower cost per transistor that we're building in semiconductors. So it's a scale business. So you have companies like TSMC, winners in this space, because they're getting bigger and bigger at manufacturing more and more transistors. In fact, transistors are the one thing we manufacture more than anything that's ever been manufactured of anything in the whole world. The second type of competitive advantage is called switching costs. So this is where a customer has a really hard time, whether it's cost, time, money, information, to switch away from you. Think about aircraft and all the parts that go into it. I mean, it's very, very expensive for Airbus or Boeing to switch out any part of that aircraft. It has to be recertified with at least 500-600 pages of certification material. So they just won't do it. And those switching costs create competitive advantage for aerospace manufacturing businesses. The third one is physical assets. So we call them non-replicable physical assets. Here, the classic monopoly type example is a railroad, right? Once you've laid the track, and in the US, there are only just six class one, so large railroad companies, which have consolidated from 120 over the last 100 years. And these companies control the railroads in the US. And those railroads are not essentially assets that we're going to be able to replicate again, because no one's going to rebuild that track. And that creates a competitive advantage for those businesses. The final two, one's related to kind of government or like legally enforced or in place a competitive advantage, which is anything to do with regulation, but really hard regulation. So we're talking like intellectual property, like patents for pharmaceuticals, things like that. I think that's a very powerful moat as well. And finally, which is one of my favorites, is network effects. This is the idea that every individual user that the company adds to its network increases the value for the other users, locking them into this network. And a great example of that is a financial exchange. We all trade every day, but the reality is there's only a handful of financial exchanges around. Why? Because liquidity is attracted to other liquidity. So traders attract to other people trading. And the more people trade on a venue, the more valuable that liquidity is to other people trading on that venue. And so you see a concentration of trading into just a handful of venues. And that, I think, is really powerful. So if you take those together, there's one that's conspicuously missing, which I'm sure we'll cover in a second. But those are what we see as tangible moats. And that's really been the core of what we focus on in terms of moats in our fund.
Thank you, Yuri. And I think I know the exact topic you're referring to there. But first, Martin, you've written in the past about moats and even saying in an article last year, quote, "We like boring companies that have dividends of 5 or 6%, complemented by protective moats that help ensure the timing and amounts of future cash flows." So Martin, this is kind of a two-parter. Are boring companies more or less the safest investments? And what types of moats ring most important for you personally when picking an investment?
Well, I'm a Canadian and we got plenty of moats up here. We're, our whole stock exchange is dominated by companies operating in oligopoly type structures, good and bad. So, you know, there's good companies within each of those areas in telecom, in banking, utilities. And so, from an investment standpoint, there are some opportunities for weeding out the good and the bad and the ugly in between each of those segments of the market. But if you look at boring, you know, boring is okay. Boring, if you can compound boring and you get a nice spread, you know, a nice yield, and a lot of older investors, conservative investors, are looking for tax efficient yield, dividend investing is quite attractive in Canada. But you got to make sure you get the quality right, as per what we talked about. And so you've got to do your homework. And the best way is just by your own personal experience. For example, my personal experience more recently was, you know, just go visit a branch at a Canadian bank. TD's, for example, has gotten a lot of trouble more recently south of the border in your neck of the woods in the U.S. But visiting the branch, the service that I saw there was nowhere near close to what we saw, what I've seen through my own bank at the Royal Bank. And you can see that in the performance, a huge performance spread between the two. Actually, the Royal Bank's outperformed the S&P 500 this year, and it has a nice, healthy dividend and some growth there. And so high-quality company with a sustainable dividend that's quite boring, but, you know, taking names and kicking butt. Same thing in our telecommunications space. My own personal experience with Bell up in Canada has just been atrocious, and compared to TELUS. And you can see that, in the share price performance and the quality. And so I posted a thing on the chat about what we look for. And it's companies, high quality companies treat their employees like their partners and like their clients themselves, and not transactions. And that flows through to the end client. So you have to be very careful about moats, that you don't get caught in a value trap because of that said moat, because that could lead to complacency within it. And so there are winners and losers within those segments of the market that that do have that protection. And so, you know, that's my experience within Canada. And then looking outside of Canada in like the larger tech space, which does have a lot of protective moats and its growthier segment of the market, that's much different than the dividend style area. We want to make sure that that growth can continue to deliver. And so it's a nice balance to each other. So, you know, that's our take on things.
Beautifully said, and you actually hit two of the topics I wanted to pivot to next. So I'm going to go ahead and do that. This next one might be setting up for good conversation. So feel free to chime in on this one, all three of you. There is one area that it seems like there might be a little bit of disagreement, and we'll kind of spin this into an all hands on deck discussion, like I said. So thinking about intangible asset value, especially the concept of brands. Brands are often seen as kind of this powerful part of a business that creates a really powerful, strong moat via that brand power. Jerome, you do include brand-focused businesses like Nike and Adidas as high-quality companies, whereas Yuri, you seem to disagree with this, and your fund doesn't feature any consumer and media-focused companies where this brand power dominates. And then Martin, on the other hand, you do seem to focus much more on fundamentals and have even voiced outright skepticism toward certain sectors that overemphasize brand dominance, like tech, which we'll get to in a minute. Jerome, if you could start us off here, break down from your point of view why a brand, a strong brand, think like PepsiCo, Coca-Cola, can be considered a moat. And then we'll pass it around a panel to hit all sides of this discussion.
Yes, that's a very good question. And I think it can be a little bit counterintuitive for a lot of people, because when you look at the performance of a lot of brands, you quoted like PepsiCo or Nike, you see a huge performance, and you can be confused. You can be confused between the concept of mods and total shareholder return. And so, for me, a brand is certainly a form of competitive advantage. You create something that has value, that allows you to gain customer. But I think as a mod, it's probably one of the weakest one. Why? Because when you are a brand, you're vulnerable to shifts in customer trends. And we see that actually currently with Nike. And I talked about market share, but Nike currently is losing market share. So I think that we can see that Nike has a kind of decreasing moat. At least it's what we see with the market share. And before Nike, there was Adidas. And Adidas was also the dominant player in the shoe market before. And now it's Nike. But for how long, I think it's really complicated to predict how long a brand can last. And I think that brands also face various risks, such as reputational damage. When your main asset is your image, of course, reputation is really important. And today, I will give an example. For instance, a brand of LVMH, that is Dior, was in front of in a controversy, I think, a few months ago, because they found that there was some kind of non-legal work inside their supply chain. And of course, for a luxury brand, a customer cannot understand why you have a supply chain that is not 100% good and so on. And so, of course, for the image of Dior, it's a very bad thing. And this reputation, I think it's risky to identify it as a mod. Additionally, I think that a good way to look at brands is to focus on emerging brands, and so brands that are gaining market share. So again, I'm very focused on market share, but I think it's a good way to identify which brands are gaining momentum and are gaining mods, and which one are not. And so that's all.
Fair enough. Thank you, Jerome. I think that was a pretty good breakdown and a pretty good way to kind of expound on the question I asked about brands and maybe even perhaps staying power. Really good description of the risks therein as well. Yuri, I would love to hear your take on brands as a factor, as a moat of quality companies, because it's my understanding that you don't agree that it is.
Yeah. So when we sat down to think about this, and really it was distilling kind of well over a decade of kind of investing experience to try to narrow this down, I reflected on kind of investing experience over the last decade. And I thought about brands, which often get mentioned in the same breath as moat. I mean, Warren Buffett famously, you know, was an investor in Coca-Cola over many years, and he loves that business, both as a consumer and a person who's invested in it. But what we saw in the last decade, and especially over the COVID period, is just incredible how quickly new brands can come up out of nowhere. Often this has really been powered by social media, and particularly brand power of celebrities. So individual celebrities give their backing to brands and build them up and even create their own brands. And out of nowhere, I mean, if you look at the Kardashian family as an example, you can build a brand very, very quickly. It's also been a revolution in tech, right? You now have, I think, a lot of the infrastructure that you need to set up web shops, to power the ads, to reach the people, including your own social power, and equally the logistics infrastructure where you can just borrow off providers that can do it at scale for you. So quickly, you can build direct-to-consumer brands. And we've seen that massive change in terms of direct-to-consumer brands disrupting every corner of the market, from the grocery store to sneakers to you name it. And that just to me means an assault on market share. And then you throw a bit of venture-backed money behind it, which likes these kinds of direct-to-consumer subscription businesses and things like that. You suddenly have a competitive environment, which is difficult for existing brands to navigate. And you've seen that in some of the troubles with the companies like Nike as well. I think the term brand can all, you know, it's still powerful, right? If you think about it in the sort of B2B context, a lot of the businesses that we invest in, they have built brands that are synonymous with their reputation and trust over a long period of time. People do go to those businesses, but I think they go to them because of the services they provide, not because of the name. Whereas with a lot of consumer brands, it's sometimes the brand attracts people, but there's just so much competition now. That's really our view on consumer businesses. It's just a lot more competitive, hard to find good ones.
Understood. Thank you, Yuri. So we do keep kind of lightly hinting at this topic of tech, and I actually have questions for each of you three on the topic of big tech. Martin, you've voiced a lot of skepticism in the past towards certain sectors that overemphasize brand dominance, as I mentioned, such as technology and some consumer brands, especially when they become overvalued. You've even warned against getting caught up in tech stocks when they're overpriced, despite their strong market presence and branding. So, Martin, what are your thoughts today on big tech? And is the hype overplayed with tech stocks all sitting in a precarious, overvalued sea? I think this crazy performance has been going on for 18 months, maybe even longer now. So I would love your thoughts there, Martin.
Yeah, we're in a FOMO market. You have one company that equals 12% of US GDP. And to put that into perspective, during the dot-com bubble, you had Cisco that was only 5.5% of GDP. So we've been here before, but just not at this level. So, you know, there's no doubt that companies like NVIDIA are outstanding companies and in the right place at the right time. And but if you take a look at what's happening in that segment of the AI market, you've had $10 trillion of market cap created. That's just astounding. And, you know, that's three times the size of three Canadian stock markets all put together. And rightly so, there's been some tremendous growth there. But again, if you back it up, how much of a concentration risk do you have? And you have U.S. households with almost half of their total assets in equities. And that's, again, the highest since the tech-com bubble. And so you naturally, with the shift towards ETF investing, you know, that you do have segments like tech taking a larger and larger component. And investors have to own it, and fund managers have to own it. Otherwise, you face career risk, and you lose clients for not tracking the upside. And so if you look at the last 12 months, as you had just mentioned previously, you've got almost all of the entire fund flow going into the tech sector. And so you have to own it. And my concern about that is there's no doubt about it. For example, if back in 1999, if you bought Microsoft, outstanding company, it grew its free cash flow through to 2012 by 300%. Great company, but you lost 54% of your investment simply because it had a multiple compression on judgment day, which is 2012. But if you bought it in 2012 to now, you made 12 times your money and it had exactly the same free cash flow growth. And so it's the amalgamation of future expectations is important, and understanding the valuations. There's no doubt about it. Microsoft is taking names and kicking ass, and it's an outstanding company. And you probably want to own it. But if you're coming into the market now, what's it going to look like in 10 years? And what's that value at judgment day is going to be? And there's no doubt that I have full confidence that a company like Microsoft is going to have the same kind of brand recognition, if not better, in the next decade. But is that reflected in its valuation? And then you look at companies like NVIDIA, which is a completely outside the sandbox, different story that who knows what the heck it's going to look like. And so you compare it to, you know, some of the things I've mentioned previously about being boring, and you know, looking at Royal Bank that's done better than the S&P 500. and getting a 5% dividend. For my types of investors, you know, that's the type of stuff that that's a little bit more attractive, because it just removes all that uncertainty around it.
Beautifully said, Martin. Thank you. Jerome, I'm also curious about your view on technology in its current state and how you see moats in this sector. Do you agree mostly with Martin, or do you have a bit of a different point of view there?
No, I kind of agree. Maybe to add some new elements. I think in tech, you have a lot of innovations, and so the world is evolving really rapidly, and you have new solutions that can quickly render older ones obsolete. And additionally, you have often high net profit margins and huge capital efficiency, and that can attract competitors. I think it's important in this environment to focus on one element for the tech industry, one component of moat, that is the switching cost. I think that switching cost is the main focus to have on tech companies. And switching costs, I think, are bigger for B2B tech companies. I think that if you have somebody working in IT that already had to implement SAP, he doesn't want to do it again. It was too complicated. It took 4 years of its life, and it was a lot. And of course, if you're a manager, if you spent a lot of money to have SAP, and you want to change it, it will cost money. It will be risky. It will be maybe be less efficient after than before. And so the switching cost is really too high. And that's the kind of business I like in the tech sector.
Thank you much, Jerome. Yuri, kind of looking through the holdings of your fund here, it doesn't seem like you have any big tech stocks as well. So I would love your take here, how you're feeling about big tech and about the kind of hold they seem to have with the hype in the media, et cetera. Because like I mentioned earlier, big tech's been kind of dominating the entirety of the market over the past year and a half, maybe even 2 years. And the narrative that stocks only go up in tech seems to still be pretty strong. So what are your thoughts, Yuri?
Yeah, this is a really big topic. I'll probably say three things, which I think are worth highlighting that maybe some people out there aren't aware of, sort of tech. But I think the first thing is maybe the way we thought about our fund is we think we want to give clients and investors something a bit different than what they've already got. And if you own the S&P 500 today, you know, you've got 30-40% of your fund already in these companies. I think the top 10 is 37%, a record number in the S&P 500. So you're making quite an active stock decision buying the index fund right now. What we think is investors should be thinking about, okay, how do I diversify away from this? Because I'm probably overexposed in my portfolio. But they'll look at the big tech companies and they'll realize, as Martin was saying, that they're actually pretty good businesses, right? In terms of their growth rate, particularly. Tech in general is a pretty fast growing part of the market, high margins, good free cash flow generation. And so the fear, I think, with investors is obviously a fear of missing out on this concentration of stocks going up, but also I don't want to sacrifice the quality of these businesses. And that's where we think our fund fits in and some of the investments, because what we're trying to do is find companies that have similar good growth rates, good quality businesses. So you're not diversifying, if you will. You're diversifying into other areas of growth, but you're not making it worse in terms of its quality. I think that's the point number one. Point number two is essentially about just the tech business in general. I think one of the things I was reflecting on analyzing it is it's incredible to me how many businesses have coalesced across around one business model. And that business model is advertising. I mean, if you people probably aren't aware, but if you open the typical Amazon page right now, most of the things that you'll see on that page, something like 75% of that web page real estate is ads. And those are ads paid for by the different sellers on Amazon. And this is one of the biggest business lines within Amazon. It's the fastest growing. But one of the things about ads is that everyone's creating into it, you know, from Spotify to Uber to Walmart. And advertising spending is the same market that they're all going for. So therefore, it becomes a lot more competitive than people give it credit for. And that's why we sort of shy away from the tech sector, especially areas like that, where you look at that and you say, well, that's very, very competitive. You're all competing for the eyeballs of all of these individuals looking at these display ads and purchasing decisions, et cetera. And we think that that could be problematic. So I think there are weaknesses within the tech business models that we don't like, that move them away from our moat criteria. Similarly, we're trying to give investors something different without sacrificing the growth that you see out there in big tech companies. That's generally our view on tech.
Thank you, Yuri. So one thing I want to just... Sorry about that. I disconnected my mic. So one thing that I wanted to touch on before we wrap things up today, and I think is a very important topic, is that of valuation. So many investors understand that quality is obviously something that they want in their portfolio, but they often see very high valuations for some of these companies. And I'm going to kick this one around the panel again, but Martin, can you break down your thoughts on valuation in the context of quality investing? What exactly do you look for to determine that value?
Well, I'm looking at what I'm going to get in the future. What cash flows am I going to get? And in addition, free cash flow growth am I going to achieve from investing in that said company or that segment of the market? And then what's my safety margin? Things go wrong, something happens in that segment of the market, whether maybe they have excessive exposure to interest rates in either direction, or maybe there's tariff exposure, or maybe there's a sort of risk. How much of that can be protected in the event of those events happening? And so I look at free cash flow multiples, I look at price to earnings, I look at the quality of the earnings, And then I make my allocations there. And so if you take a look at, you could do some comparisons in different jurisdictions. So for example, if you're looking at the financial segment of the market, Canadian financials are offering a 3.5% yield and trading at 17 times earnings, which is a comparable to 1.5% in the US with a 17 times earnings. So you get a nice pickup on yield for a similar multiple in Canada. And Canada has a much more protected market than the US when it comes to banking. And it was the bellwether through the 2008 financial crisis, and it still is quite robust. And so, you know, from a valuation and quality standpoint, you know, some of the Canadian banks look more attractive to us than some of the US banks. And you can do the same thing in energy. You could do the same thing in utility segment. Utility market, for example, the U.S. has outperformed the Canadian market simply because of the bolt-on from artificial intelligence empowering artificial intelligence. They're trading at similar yields on a price-to-earnings multiple, but utility segments trading at, you know, offering in Canada 5.5% yield versus 2.5% in the U.S., although you've been rewarded for that potential AI segment. But if you're, I mean, we're a goals-based investor. Our clients are targeting, most of our clients took a lot of risk in generating their capital through the businesses, and they want to preserve that capital and get a half decent return, you know, 6 to 8%. How do we do that and minimize the drawdowns? And so they're okay missing some of the sexier segments of the market if they can get those kinds of returns. And so that's why it's important to look at those valuations and do those comparisons.
Yuri, I'll spin this back to you. Your fund follows what you call four pillars of investing, and valuation is one of them. How do you approach valuation in the TOL ETF, and kind of what are the most important factors within that?
Yeah, I think valuation is very, very important, right? Because sometimes markets get overvalued, and valuation is also a good tool for finding companies that are really high quality and have great moats that are somehow there's some sort of short-term problem that you can take advantage of. But typically, the market isn't that bad at seeing what a quality company looks like. So sometimes you struggle with valuation because, you know, they're fairly valued. In those situations, what we do in our analysis, we want to make sure that the fundamentals are there and that the business can continue to generate growth in earnings, which is really how you get the share price to go up. And often in our modeling, what we assume is the valuation multiple won't go down, or maybe goes down a little bit. And then using that model, once we've built our kind of earnings model, plus the dividend and share buyback as well, which goes into that, you can create what we call like an internal rate of return. But in that internal rate of return, you've assumed no valuation increase and probably sometimes a modest valuation decrease. And what we do then is we watch like a hawk what happens to valuations. And we watch very, very carefully the risks to valuation, because sometimes with quality businesses, you get situations where if something breaks, the market is very quick to judge, especially for companies that are maybe a higher value than the rest of the market, a structural, what I would call, problem that may be a cyclical problem. But the big things that we watch out for that can really break the valuation story of a company is a bad capital allocation by the management team, so buying value-destructive M&A, or regulation where governments get involved and change something drastically for that business. So those things I watch very carefully and make sure they don't happen. And those are for the fair value businesses. Now, of course, sometimes if they fall below that fair value, they're very interesting and attractive valuation opportunities for us. So we build a valuation case like that, and we find that that works quite well in the marketplace as a way of using valuation both as an offense and a defense. In general, when you look at our portfolio, I was doing in calculations the other day, is we look across lots of different quality metrics, and typically our portfolio is somewhere between 20 to 50% higher quality across things like free cash flow conversion, growth, margins, those kinds of things. Share count decline as well. You know, on average, our companies are cutting their share count by 5%. So they're buying back 5% of the company every year. And you get that kind of 20, 30% at a small premium to the S&P 500 valuation based on free cash flow yield. So we think that what we're trying to do is find that kind of portfolio of companies that you're not paying that much more for, but you're getting a lot more for quality, which will compound over time. And that's the idea of the fund as well.
Thank you, Yuri. Jerome, when you're kind of sifting through the data, the information, making your stock picks, in terms of valuation, what do you most look for before making those selections?
Yeah, what I do in my decision-making process is that I try to calculate the potential total shareholder return that I can have in the future. And I think when you look at the market right now, because maybe there is a trend towards quality, you don't see a lot of bargain, especially in the US and especially in the large cap environment. And when I try to calculate the TSR, usually I find between 8% to maybe 13 or 15% a year, which can be good depending on your objective, but I find it a little bit low for me. and that's why I recently began to move towards small caps, because I find a lot of interesting companies with a growing market share, with huge growth, with total addressable market that is easy to calculate, and it's easy to identify whether it's sustainable or not to maintain a 10% revenue growth a year, or maybe a 20%, or maybe a 30%, where you can identify whether your acquisition will be interesting or not. And I think that in the small cap environment, you have a lot of interesting ideas that you can use as an investor. Yeah, I think that's all.
Thank you, Jerome. I mean, really good points across the board here. I think this was a very, very useful panel for those who are just kind of getting started out, those who want to understand more about how stocks are picked and invested in by folks who have been doing it, you know, for decades. So I think this experience for our listeners has been really good and really useful. So what I want to do is, while we've got all three of you here, I just want to ask for the whole panel, for those who are interested in quality investing, who are interested in getting started and making their picks for their long-term portfolios, what is the most important piece of advice you could give them? So let's start with Martin here and then go to Jerome and have Yuri send us home.
My biggest advice would be, do not confuse quality with value. It's important to, just because something is cheap doesn't mean that there's quality there. And sometimes people confuse the two. Do your homework, understand the company, understand where it's, how it's positioned within its environment. And because it if it's a dividend or income focus, doesn't mean it's just quality. You can have quality in high growth. For example, my own company, Wellington Altus, we would be, if we were in the U.S., we'd be the fastest growing U.S. RIA. We've gone from $4 billion to $35 billion in 4 years, huge growth. And we're doing so by disrupting the Canadian banks that aren't doing a good job of servicing their advisors, or and they're leaving and coming over to us. And we've got some really high quality people and high quality processes within our company. And you know, we're rewarded for it appropriately with valuations and such. So look at quality separate from value, and look at the area that you want to focus in. Do you want to focus on income? Do you want to focus on growth? Do your homework on the quality of those teams and how they treat their employees and how they treat their people. Look at Glassdoor, talk to the employees of those companies. If they treat their employees very well, then they're going to treat their clients very well, and it's going to be they could have a greater brand, and then look at the value and see how much of a safety margin there is in case, you know, shit goes wrong and something happens. How is your investment protected from a value standpoint? And so I really think it's important to make that distinction.
Thank you, Martin. And of course, as always, thank you for joining us today and giving us your expertise and feedback on all of these topics. I know there's a lot going on with everything involved in quality investing. So
thanks again for having me. This is great.
Absolutely. Your voice is always much appreciated. Jerome, what is the single most important piece of advice you could give to a new investor interested in quality investing?
I think that's to focus on business models and market shares. If you have to do only one thing, I think it's the most important thing to do. And I think probably it's important to avoid the noise, especially in a platform like Twitter, where you see a lot of experts telling you that the stock is dead, that the business model will not work because you have a change in price of maybe 5%. I think this can be very destructive for your total return, and focusing on business model and market shares are very, very important.
Thank you, Jerome, and as well, thank you for coming and giving us kind of a new voice and a new perspective. It was really nice having you here today, and I think a really good topic for you to make your debut with our panels. And I couldn't agree more with the ignore the noise on Twitter. We all know how loud it can get. We know how, you know, there's a lot of shadiness that can happen in social media. So it's really good to pay pretty close attention to what you're reading and what people are saying. Yuri. Last but not least, of course, today's sponsor, Tama ETFs. What is the biggest piece of advice you can give new investors interested in quality investing? And of course, if there's anything related to Toll that you want to tag on here before we send folks off into their afternoons, please feel free.
Yeah, look, it's a journey with investing. It's a real passion. I think a lot of young investors, when they're joining the stock market, you have to appreciate that you have a lot of people whose full-time job and passion is trying to find these companies. I think you've got to dedicate the time and the effort to looking at it. And quality investing is a great area because there you're learning about the best businesses. So it gives you lessons about other types of investing as well, like transformations and other areas as well. So I think if you're up for it and it is a real dedication, often what I would say is just use common sense. The basics really do take care of themselves, especially in this field. And just try to focus and not get dragged into other ways of making money in the stock market and having this sort of FOMO of things going up, and stick to a consistent long-term process and let the compounding do the work for you. Of course, if you're not up for that, I think it's a good idea to allocate, you know, core of your portfolio to quality stocks through using funds in other areas as well. On that note, you know, you can read more about our fund for sure on our website, which is www.temaetfs.com. There's just more information about the TOL fund. We've written quite a few articles recently, especially about new ways of thinking about moats and that kind of thing, that you can learn more about. And we use lots of examples. So, you know, for those that are interested in doing direct investing themselves can look at that as well. So yeah, on that note, thanks very much for having me.
Beautifully said, Yuri. And again, thank you so much for sponsoring this space with Tama ETFs. I think this is a really important topic that doesn't get driven home quite enough in these big market-related panels. A lot of it is a lot of FOMO for what's happening, whatever the hottest topic is. I think this was a really good way to kind of slow down that thought process and let these folks kind of hear from experts how they're doing their type of investing. So thank you again, everybody, for coming. If you're not following these three folks, please do. They're posting nonstop information, education, takes on sectors and companies. And of course, Tama has myriad ETFs that they're managing, a lot of expertise going on there. Thank you again to Tama ETFs for sponsoring us today and making this panel happen. And yeah, I mean, I couldn't have expected this to go any better. This was really great, you guys. Thank you. Have a great rest of your day, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.